We are going to look today at the next chapter in the book of Timothy. And the book of Timothy is helping us to discover among the church family what's true and what's false. What is the true message of a local church? And who are the true teachers within a local church? And we're going to see that Paul describes basically, and this is going to be fun to do, how does a church work? How does a local church work? And so we're going to dig into what God instructs Timothy through the Apostle Paul in his letter to Timothy as an emerging elder in the church of Ephesus. And essentially, most of us have submitted already, without even knowing it, we've already submitted to somebody's leadership. Without knowing it, most of us have submitted ourselves to a variety of different kinds of leaders, right? I mean, most of you submitted yourselves to your parents, whether you liked it or not, growing up. Most of us have submitted ourselves to teachers and coaches and bosses and law enforcement, superintendents, governors, and probably even fewer of us, but many of us few have submitted ourselves to a elected president, one way or other. It makes me think, as we've submitted ourselves to a variety of leaders, what kind of leaders were they? And what qualifications are there for getting that job? Have you ever come across a leader, I'm wondering, probably maybe at work or at school or something, and when you were participating in whatever it was as that person led, have you ever asked yourself, how did they get that job? Have you ever dealt with a customer service manager, and when you're done, you're like, I don't know how they got a customer job. Somebody must have not shown up for work for a month, and they're like, who will do it? You're here, you get the job. Who designated the qualifications for those leadership roles? How do people get those leadership jobs? And if they were unqualified, did that matter to you? I remember how much it mattered to me when I was a young Little League baseball player or a Little League father, and I remember the all-star coach was somehow able to get all of the kids whose dads were coaches on the all-star team. Does that make sense? So the all-star coach gets a team full of kids, and every coach's kid is on the all-star team. And I used to think to myself, even as a Little League player, I'm not sure that kid's even the third best player on their team. How do they do it? How does an all-star coach get the job? And I come to realize over time, as a Little League parent, they were willing to do it. It's just a person who's willing to take the job, and if you're willing to take the job, oftentimes you get the job. And that mattered to the parents of the child who didn't get the spot. That mattered. The qualifications for Little League coaches all of a sudden mattered. Willing, not necessarily able. Or willing and able, but not necessarily any real, in this particular case, the character needed to make a hard decision to tell another coach's kid, hey, not going to make it this year. So when we get to our next meeting, you're going to be frustrated for sure. But we don't care so much about Little League leaders. We don't care so much about other leaders that maybe we bump into who have customer service jobs. But we do, as a church family, we do care quite a bit about church leaders. And we care about how those church leaders end up church leaders. Now, here's what Paul does. You remember we spent a lot of time talking about how Paul said, hey, there's some really, really bad leaders in the church. Weed them out. Filter them out, weed them out, confront them out, wedge them out. Somehow they've got to be out. Continue to pray for their salvation, pray for their soul, but we can't have them leading, damaging, and distorting the church. So essentially today, here's what we're going to see. Paul builds a healthy church on a foundation of qualified leaders. So to get a healthy church, Paul says, let's build the foundation. The foundation is going to be healthy leaders. Sometimes. What's the criteria for qualified leaders? Is Paul going to say, find some willing people? Or is he going to say, find some faithful people that are just continuing to show up? Or does he say, make sure that you pick the successful ones, the popular ones, the ones that everybody seemingly really likes? And the truth is that because of this, Paul is saying a church should never be subjected to unqualified leaders. A church family should not have the pain, suffering, heartache, and hardship of leadership that's unqualified. It's expected among the church that there would be some who have a desire and who aspire to be church leaders. It's expected. And that they would have a desire and to aspire to serve their church family in leadership. Look what Paul says about it. He says, this is a trustworthy saying. He's writing to Timothy, who is overseeing the church at Ephesus. He says, if someone aspires to be a church leader, he desires an honorable position. Now, I had kind of come to believe that anybody who wanted to be a leader among the church shouldn't be a leader. Doesn't that make sense? Like, if someone wants to be a leader, shouldn't you kind of like question, like, why do you want to be a leader? And I think that it's true that if somebody wants it too bad, there's probably a good reason that they are disqualified. But I was kind of semi-surprised to discover that Paul says, if someone aspires, there are people who God has put it in their heart to aspire to serve their church in these leadership roles. And if they do, it's an honorable position. Now, if you've come across a thriving, high-profile church, you may have encountered one of their leaders, and they have titles like executive director. Or if you've attended, you may have noticed that these same churches, they have executives that are treated like celebrities, and they have attenders who are considered customers. And I should mention to you that executive directors, customers, celebrities, and attenders aren't mentioned in the Bible. That isn't a part of the DNA of finding and installing leaders among the church. While finding and using the best leadership titles we know aren't necessarily essential to build a healthy church, like you don't have to nail the titles, it is true that there's so many reasons why churches should get rid of, abandon, or otherwise reconsider titles like executive, director, and also the idea that any attender is a customer. And we replace them with different words, different titles for different roles. And those roles are elder, deacon, and member. Super easy. Elder, deacon, and member. So here's what we learn in 1 Timothy chapter 3. Here's what we learn. God's church family is designed to be led and loved by men and women who exercise his delegated authority. God has authority. He gives it to his son. His son baptizes in the Spirit. The Spirit enables the church to become the church, and then the church is led by people who have delegated authority. And these people have delegated authority, and you see it in the New Testament gospel churches that there are three kinds of leaders, and they take responsibility for the health and the progress of the local church. And we're going to inspect each of these roles briefly. We'll inspect each of these roles in just kind of a short kind of overview. Also, these three are the leadership roles that we have currently and are building on here among the North Central Church family. So the first one is this, selected elders. Now, when you hear the word elder, you shouldn't think older. You shouldn't think that. Even though elder implies that, elder does not mean older. Timothy, for example, was not older than the church members in the church of Ephesus. He was younger. In fact, Paul said to him, don't let them despise you because of how young you are. So elder doesn't mean older, but the church is supposed to have elders who are selected by other elders. And those are oftentimes, in our context, we call those elders pastors. They're overseers who've been appointed. The church elders appoint through the qualifications that we'll look at carefully other elders. And they oversee the shepherding of the church family. And they have a job description to do the work of, to equip the church members to do the work of ministry. So the elders, pastors aren't necessarily the primary doers. They're the primary overseers who are involved in charge of equipping, helping people get the tools, the knowledge, the opportunities to actually do the work of meeting needs among the church. The pastor elder takes on the role of vision, teaching, training, and selecting other leaders, and also shepherding the church. And there's so many good things that go along with that. Oftentimes in the New Testament, you'll hear elders referred to in plurality, with the idea that it's better to have a plural team of leaders rather than just depending on one. It safeguards both the church and it safeguards both that leader. The Old Testament style of leadership would be anoint the king. New Testament style would be find someone to provide servant leader oversight and do it with a team of people who are carrying the same responsibility. So the congregation and its role is to acknowledge God-given authority that comes with these roles in its leadership, and also to follow the leadership that they give to as far as they can. So secondly, there is elected and selected deacons. So there's a role in the church leadership that's called a deacon. And that deacon, the word in the New Testament for deacon simply means servant. Pretty simple. And those deacons can be elected or selected. We see an election in Acts chapter 6 when the apostles were saying, like, we're equipping and teaching and we're in prayer together and we really need someone to elect from among you people who are qualified to serve as a sort of deacon. So these deacons are responsible for caring and serving the church family. And they basically function as kind of pastoral assistants, and they lead various aspects of the church. They do so right alongside the elders. And practically, elders and deacons work very, very closely together, kind of like a left hand and a right hand, with elders specializing in their words and leading with their words, and deacons specializing in leading with their actions, their works, the things that they do. Deacons are also qualified for ministry by qualifications that are nearly identical to elders, with the exception that the elders also have a very distinct qualification called able to teach. Or able to, maybe some of you know the way that Paul writes this, able to rightly divide the scriptures and teach, not just know it and live it, but also to help kind of equip other people to know it and believe it themselves. So the deacons have the same criteria without the teaching, and so we also see that these are servant leaders, they're not directors. And then I need to mention this, selected elders are shepherds that are overseeing, they're not executives of the church. So from qualifications in the New Testament can infer that deacons generally will be the ones who are elected or selected to oversee the finances of the church, also oversee the facilities of the church. Oftentimes, it's the deacons who have responsibility for managing church membership, the systems of the church. Perhaps they are involved in overseeing the mercy ministries of the church, serving segments of people, maybe kids or students or seniors, or maybe these deacons will serve the distressed and widowed. But they will also find themselves involved in overseeing segments of people in a way that helps them kind of get to know people's very, very private lives. And that's why this criteria is so important for them. And thirdly, there's baptized members. So we have elders, deacons, and baptized members. Baptized members are kind of like, these are inducted into the church membership through baptism and then some other kinds of unity, building unity criteria. These are typically people who are maturing disciples that help their church flourish by giving. Members are giving. They give their God-given talents, their God-given time, and their God-given treasure, and they participate in helping to build up the strength of the church by investing themselves. When they call a church their home, they take responsibility to make sure the church is healthy, make sure the church is growing. How many of you have raised kids and you remember the phase of life where you said to them, you are a contributing part of this family. You have to contribute. Anybody ever do that? Anybody ever say, you have never contributed one thing. Today's the last day. We're going in another direction. Jim Gaffigan says he finally got to the point where he says to the last kid, we're going to have to let you go. Too many. So they help build up the church strong by taking what God has given them in open-handedness, time, talent, and treasure, and they make that investment. And this shows up not just in what they feel about their church, but especially in what they do, the way they give and the way they serve. Now, maturing church members are the kinds of church members who begin to see clearly that their church isn't primarily devoted to meeting their preferences, right? A maturing church member begins to realize that God intends to reach everyone. And the things that reached me may not be the things that reached my kids or may not be the things that will reach my grandkids. And while members, of course, are always devoted to the gospel, which means the message never changed, but the means, the method, the format over time kind of takes the shape of the changing world and the changing needs of our kids and grandkids. There's a variety of people, including our neighbors and coworkers, and that have needs that the church members contribute to, not just their own preferences. So who gets selected for church membership? Here's what Paul says. Here's what he says to look for. He's going to outline qualifications. He's going to outline qualifications for overseers who are elders. And he says essentially this: they have to have character and an ability to teach. Biblical character, we call it. Qualification. Biblical criteria is biblical character and the ability to teach. And by the way, Paul is going to describe this in terms of he. He needs to be this and he needs to do that. And I want you to keep in mind that we're interpreting this as not prescriptive. We're not interpreting he as a timeless mandate, similar to when, you know the phrases in the scripture where Paul says, slaves, obey your masters. We tend not to think, oh, Paul is prescribing slaves. What do we know? We know he's talking to slaves who, within the culture, would be a structure of master-slave relationship where the gospel is also meaningful to slaves. Paul is not prescribing slavery into the culture. He's reading the culture and he's saying, here's what we know. In a culture of patriarchy, I'm going to talk to the men about the qualifications are in their leadership. So we interpret that not as a timeless mandate, but as a measure that's being taken to fit that culture. So when selecting leaders, what does Paul say? Specifically, elders and deacons. What does he say? So a church leader must be a man whose life is above reproach. He must be faithful to his wife. He must exercise self-control, live wisely, and have a good reputation. He must enjoy having guests in his home. And he must be able to teach. That's the eldership line. Then he must not be a heavy drinker or be violent. He must be gentle, not quarrelsome, and he must not love money. I think, you know, it's tempting to think that if someone is a really, really good church leader, they take a vow of poverty. But I also notice that Paul doesn't say that they must not have money. He says they must not love money, right? They must not, they might be broke, but they don't have to be broke, right? They might learn to live in poverty, but they don't believe it's a part of the criteria. But loving money, what do we know about the love of money? It is the root of what brings evil. In fact, he says, rich people have pierced themselves with many sorrows, pursuing and chasing. So anyway, so there's a list of church leadership, eldership and deacons. Essentially, here's what he says. Look for aspiring members who are respected members, right? Respected members who are aspiring to church leadership. They're open and willing to be church leaders. And look for spiritual maturity and credible influence. spiritual maturity, credible influence, there's a respectability about them, and they are aspiring to leadership. Specifically for elders, this is added as well, and an ability to teach. And where should we look for the evidence of their respectable maturity and their credible influence? Where do we look? Well, we look, according to Paul, in their family. Paul says he must manage his own family well, having children who respect and obey him. For if a man cannot manage his own household, how can he take care of God's church? Pretty reasonable question, right? I mean, I think it's a pretty reasonable question that he's asking here. So, in summary, also, he says, people outside the church must speak well of him. A deacon must be faithful to his wife, and he must manage his children and household well. So there's the three passages where you get to see what Paul is saying is, how do we know if somebody is respected? How do we know if they have credible influence? How do we know if there's spiritual maturity? How do we know if they're able to equip and teach? We are able to see who they are at home, and also we're able to notice that outside the church, what's happening? People are speaking well of them. So, this is what we see in summary. We inspect their reputation, and we do so inside their home and among the community. My friend, I have this friend of mine in town that tells me this, told me this hilarious one story one time when we were talking about where we could go to do business, and you know, I brought up a couple of different people that I knew who did a certain kind of business, and then I said, "But you know what? Isn't there this business person in town?" And aren't they a Christian? And he goes, "Oh, yeah, I know who you mean. People in my neighborhood call him the Christian crook." I was like, "Really?" Like, "Oh, yeah, famous. Not only is he well known as a crook, but he's very well known among the community as the Christian crook who hands out tracts at his business and shares, you know, praise with people and whatever. And then it's perceived that he goes on to rip them off." And I think to myself, that is a painful nickname for somebody to be given in business, right? It's one thing to be the to have some well-known reputation. It's another thing to build the reputation outside the community so when people think of you, they think, "Oh, that person's credible." So, what does Paul say? How do we know the reputation of these leaders? They've aspired from within the local church family, and they have been able to be seen and watched. Now, this describes to you why I, and among our church pastors and elders, prefer to elevate, to find, to kind of like inspect the reputation of people among our church family who we already know. It is very, very common and very, very trendy among the church to hire somebody who is a quote-unquote pastor who comes in from the outside, and the only thing you know about them is a resume and a phone call to a reference. Now, I'm wondering, doesn't it make sense that if you provide references, right? Let's say I've gone to four churches in 10 years, four churches. When I give you a reference, I can assure you the reference that I am giving you is my mom, or the equivalent of my mom, which means only sees the best, unwilling to ruin your career by telling the truth about what a knucklehead you have been everywhere you've been. Four different churches in 10 years, one to the next, to the next, to the next. This is what I want to do. I don't want to look at a resume that you can write anything on a resume. I don't want to talk to people who are only going to say good things to you. I want to know. I want to know about your reputation in your home and among your community. How do I do that? We believe among our church family, we live with these people for years, and we watch them, inspect them, know them, and begin to see credible influence among the church family. And they become aspiring members who are elected and selected to deacon roles and then pastoral leadership among a number of other different roles. In other words, I think the best kind of leader that protects the church the best is the kind of leader who you have lived with, seen them serve. You've been loved by them. You've been able to watch the way that they lead inside their home and the kind of credibility they have outside their home in the community. And the best kind of leaders come from within the church family. And there are times where that's not possible. I recognize that. In fact, it might be considered a, in our case, it might be considered a, what do they call that? An embarrassment of riches, right? Some churches really, really struggle in this area. But we get the opportunity to observe their long obedience in the same direction for many years and see them serve and be impacted by their giving. In other words, we're not willing, we're not quick to hire pastoral leadership outside of the church family. And you know our pastors, Jonathan and Rich and Yon and Amy, were people that we're able to see and watch and inspect for a long time who come with credible influence inside their home and outside in the community. And that means a lot, and Paul's describing that in the church of Ephesus, that's the kind of leaders that you're looking for. So what's at stake? What's at stake when selecting church leaders? What are we trying to avoid by doing that? What is the reason that this is so crucial? Well, here's what Paul says. God is teaching Timothy and the church through Paul so that he will not be disgraced and fall into the devil's trap. A church leader must not be a new believer because he might become proud and the devil would cause him to fall. Now, I hope you notice that in two separate, very, very unusual references in this letter and other letters, Paul refers to the devil twice. Now, if you're new to the Christian faith, you probably think I'm very familiar with the devil because there's an emoji for the devil. Red face, horns, and the caricature of the pitchfork, that's what the devil is, and obviously the devil is either imaginary creature or sits on one shoulder with an angel on the other shoulder. We believe that the devil isn't cute. We believe that the devil is the antagonist in God's design and God's story. We believe that there is an evil one who is the enemy of our soul who wants nothing more than to steal and kill and destroy God's reputation and the people who belong to him. That he is what's behind inspiring evil and deceiving sinful hearts into taking the bait and destroying their lives. Paul refers to him here as the devil. He's got other names, Satan. He uses this word devil here, and he talks about how leadership, you have to be very careful with appointing leaders because these leaders will be susceptible to the devil's trap. And leaders must not be trapped because then you find them disgraced as they fall. And be careful when you're appointing new leaders because there's a good chance that they don't know how to handle their power and they become prideful. And again, who takes advantage of them? The devil does. And the devil causes him to fall. So this is basically a snare. The devil's trap is a snare. It is a pitfall designed by the devil to exploit the weaknesses of a human heart. Some of you have come across someone who has power and you realize immediately they shouldn't have it. Someone should take their power away from them. I remember when we were visiting Niagara Falls and we were standing in line. You go from one station to the next station to the next station. Oh, Maid of the Mist. And they had handed out power to a couple of the state park agents there. And we're kind of like, this is an absolute disaster. These people who have power were basically, they're like line ushers, screaming at people, hollering at people, like confronting people, so much so that the guests of the Maid of the Mist start hollering back at them. And I thought to myself, somebody must have just gone out on the street with badges and said, "You guys, can you guys give us a hand over here, kind of corralling the lines?" And they just made them, all of a sudden they made them the person in charge of the people flow, the traffic flow. And it was tense, and it was yucky, and it made such an impression on me, I'm remembering to tell the story of how awful it was visiting the Maid of the Mist. Do you remember the Maid of the Mist? A little bit. Do you remember those awful people in charge of the lines? Oh, yeah, I do. So I walked up to one of them, and I said, "You are acting so belligerent. And I took their lanyard and I jerked it off there. I didn't do that. But I pictured it from behind in love. The devil we know uses pride, deceit, entices the heart. And here's what the devil says to leaders who are not prepared to be leaders. You're impressive. You're really impressive. I hope you're impressed with yourself because people are impressed with you. And then you start thinking, I kind of am impressive. I mean, and then what does he say? Paul says, the devil has a trap laid for them. And the pride of having power is going to cause them to fall into a trap, ultimately resulting in public humiliation. This is still happening today. In the news yesterday morning with Gateway Church in Texas, with an estimated 100,000 church attenders or members, where the founding pastor, all these past charges were stirred up, and there wasn't transparency about the sin that he had committed during the time that it had all gone public, and it all stirred up again. He's forced to resign. And then at the helm now is his own son. And his own son is evidently installed as the at the helm of Gateway Church, 100,000 members. And then yesterday I read that his son and his wife stepped down and resigned. And old Max Lucado is coming in to be the interim pastor at Gateway Church. And I think to myself that Paul is concerned about the heart of the leader, right? He's concerned about the heart of the leader. The leader fails morally and somehow falls publicly, and Paul, we know, is concerned about the heart of the leader. But look what he says. He says that this leader will be disgraced and that he has to be careful about falling. And what he's actually describing here is that there are far-reaching consequences that cost God's reputation among the community, right? What are people talking about all over the country today? That big church whose pastor had a moral failure. And then the son who steps in and then steps out and resigns for whatever reason. And so these leaders foolishly pay the high price of a tarnished reputation among the church and community. I worked with a pastor of a church that is in a town not too far from here, who said that they were on year 10 of rebuilding the church's reputation among the community because their pastor had been jailed for sexual misconduct. 10 years later, he's working on changing the name of the church to deal with the reputation of the church among the church family. And we know that that's what Paul has his eye on here, that the devil knows a leader's moral failings have far-reaching consequences to really distort not just the perception of the church, but also to distort the perception of the church's message. That if the people fail, clearly the main message fails, right? If the pastor doesn't work, then certainly the gospel doesn't work or isn't real, isn't trustworthy. So essentially, God cautions us, and here's what he says. Caution number one, don't rush them, meaning young leaders, young members, don't rush them because a prideful fall will disgrace and damage the church's reputation. There's a lot on the line. Paul is warning against taking these recent converts to leadership too quickly because of their lack of maturity. So, a part of my responsibility among our church network called the Assemblies of God is to help young leaders get a credential. And a lot of the people that we help get a credential come to us as Bible college graduates. And when Bible college graduates are applying for a credential, they can get a credential in the Assemblies of God, but I have this growing conviction that even though you might have a credential, if you're 22 years old, you're probably not an elder of the church. Why? It's too early. It's too soon. And also, it's very difficult to prove that you can, that you have credible influence among your family and among your community if you're 22 years old and you just graduated from Bible college. So you can turn over the credential, but I'm not sure you could handle eldering or pastoring the church. In fact, that means that I don't believe that a credential qualifies someone for a pastor, although it's very helpful. I think spiritual maturity and credible influence do, and that takes time to develop. So if I'm given the choice between someone who's emerging in our church family, Jonathan Valletta and Amy and Rich and Yon and so many other people that are prayerfully being raised up, or a 22, 23, 24-year-old credential holder who's graduated from a Bible college, I will lean heavily towards someone who has credible influence and spiritual maturity. Someone who you can look in their home and someone who you can look at their reputation in their community. And then prayerfully and wisely help a young credential holder kind of like be equipped to carry this responsibility, God willing, in the future if they meet the biblical criteria. That's probably a little more than you wanted to know. But that's where I'm coming from. So what would I say? So here's what I would say to other church leaders. I say to other church leaders, make sure you know what you want when you're hiring a Bible college graduate or any graduate who has who's new in their faith or new in church leadership. Be sure you know what you're looking for and be sure you know what to expect. And there are biblical criteria and biblical expectations that are vital. So how can we minimize this catastrophe? Well, before, Paul says, they are appointed as deacons, let them be closely examined. Do the work of examining. If they pass the test, then let them serve as deacons. So there's an examination, there's an inspection. Essentially, here's what he's cautioning us. He's saying, before appointing anyone, closely inspect them. The elders are inspecting potential church leaders, examining candidates for leadership, looking closely for integrity, veracity. Do the truth that they say they believe, does it match up with the truth that they're living? Are they committed to the gospel? You know what's tempting? It's tempting to put people in leadership who are willing to serve, or somebody who's been faithful. And I wonder, really quick, give me some feedback. How many of you have ever ended up in charge of something because you were there? Anybody? You were faithful. Anybody ever been given a job? You're like, who could we give this to? I know, you're here all the time. Thank you for your faithfulness. You're now the leader. And as I've said to you a couple different times over the years, I don't believe that God is looking for people who are just willing to serve. Right? I remember being told many, many times, all God's looking for is willingness. And I'm like, that sounds so right. Amen. Over the years, I'm like, but wait a second. God has given church members special abilities, which means he's looking for both willing and able. Willing and able. Somebody who's doing something faithfully, who's willing to do it, and turns out has a gift to do it or a special ability to do it. So, the reward for these kinds of church leaders is this: they're worthy of honor. They, what does it mean to honor somebody? I'm going to roughly define it this way. Honor means acknowledging the value of someone or something. That's probably the easiest off the top of my head. So these leaders are deserving honor, not adoration. These leaders are deserving respect and honor, but not worship. What would worship mean? Somebody needs them. They have elevated, they have a love for them that's above themselves, their family, above God, perhaps. Paul says, those who do well as deacons will be rewarded. What's their reward? With respect from other people. And the reason why they get honor and respect, but not adoration and worship, that's the reason why nobody should say, I need that leader. We don't need that leader. We need one leader, and it's the chief shepherd, the good shepherd. Because Jesus is the only one among the church who deserves worthy adoration and worship, right? And we should be always monitoring our own heart for honoring church leaders, but adoring Jesus alone, worshiping Jesus alone. The chief shepherd of all the world's shepherds is Jesus. And that's who the leaders are leading our people to. One of my favorite quotes that really shaped me at an early age in church leadership comes from John Stott. And John Stott said this. You ready? I hope so. I'll say it a couple times to make sure. Here's what he said. The sin of the clergy, the sin that's committed by ministers, church leaders, is to cultivate a dependence upon oneself. That's the sin of the clergy. That among the church family, that an intentional, conscious or subconscious cultivating that the church has been grown to really depend on me or on the minister or on the clergy. And John Stott said, that's the sin of the clergy. The clergy may not be out, they may not be out committing adultery and suffering from all kinds of addictions, and they may not be out doing all kinds of gossip, slander, backbiting, and other kinds of terrible sins among the community, but the sin of the clergy is to be among the church and start to cultivate, oh, you need me. You really, really need me. And here's John Stott finishing that thought, because the role of a church leader always and forever is to say, you don't need me, you need the chief shepherd. You don't need me, you need Jesus. I can help you, but I can't heal you. Jesus can heal you. It is only Jesus who can express to the church something that we call suffer love. The highest form of love is, you are suffering, but I am going to step in and I'm going to carry that suffering. I'm going to be the one to suffer in your place. Why? Because I love you. The highest form of love. Any parent that would exchange places from their suffering child is expressing suffer love. This is what Jesus did for his church. He, not the clergy, not ministers, elders, and deacons, has expressed suffer love. And Jesus describes this when he says that he himself, I am the shepherd, the good shepherd, he says. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd sacrifices his life for the sheep. The elder doesn't. The elder might give up a lucrative career out in the secular world. The elder might give up some time, might make some sacrifices that impact their family, their time, their schedule, their plans. But only Jesus gave up his life. The chief shepherd lays his life down for the sheep. And every good church leader says, I'm here to help, but Jesus is here to heal. He's who you need. He's who the church needs. He is who the community needs. So, what now? Here's what I want to invite you to do. Find your place to contribute. Pursue membership. Members are givers, giving their time, talent, and treasure. Maybe that's where you're at in pursuing your faith with not only your faith personally, but also to join the church family, a faith family. Aspire to lead. Paul says that's honorable. It's an honorable pursuit. Pray about one day becoming a church deacon or a church elder pastor. Secondly, pray for our leaders, church leaders. Pray for them, all of them. Some of them have been elected. We have trustee deacons that have been elected. We have ministry deacons who have been selected. We have pastors who have been selected. Pray for all of their health. Pray for discernment. Pray for courage. Pray over and for their marriage, their children, their family life and dynamic, their legacy. Pray for their relationships in the community that we have that are so valuable and vital, that God's reputation is on the line, and knowing a church family is praying to that end is completely, completely vital. Would you pray with me? Let's pray. Father, today we bring ourselves to you, submit ourselves to you, are grateful to you for giving us a church family and then instructing us on how to build the church on a healthy foundation, a foundation of healthy leaders. And I pray for the hearts of our church family that you would begin to stir and just turn over vision for what it would look like to serve, not just as a member, but potentially as a future church leader. And I pray that you'd cultivate this in a way that only you could, with the right intentions, with the right maturity, with the right character, that over time you'd help credibility to be grown and protected. And we're grateful for the way that you do it in us. We're grateful for the way you do it among us. We're also grateful for the ways that you have built our church family over the decades by always establishing and reestablishing health and health and health. We trust you in Jesus' name. Amen. Would you stand? We're going to sing together and celebrate all that Jesus is as our chief shepherd.